America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Thanks to Senators Sanders and Warren, we've heard repeatedly how stark and growing the inequality in wealth is between the billionaires in America, the 0.1%, and the rest of us. The numbers bear this out. Less discussed is the fact that those below the super rich, call them the wildly comfortable, the next 9.9%, have most of the wealth in the country, still leaving 90% in the dust. Who are the 9.9%ers and what advantages accrue to them? Meet the millionaires next door today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Matthew Stewart. He's a philosopher and an author of a number of books. The one that we're going to focus on today is called The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. And those are pretty strong words, Matthew, but I know you've got a lot to back it up. As somebody who might be thinking that we hear often in our society about the yawning inequality that is going on, and we attribute it so much to that 0.1% of the Elon Musks, the Bill Gates, and others. And yet you remind us that there are probably a number of people listening to this podcast who fall in this 9.9%.
Look, I think we've framed the inequality discussion as this kind of them narrative. It's all about this tiny group of crazy rich people. And I would like us to understand that it's also an us game. It also involves everyone in some way. It touches all of us, and we all get involved in the system. I mean, maybe I should step back and give some of the basic math behind this 9.9% number. Does that sound like a reasonable?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think, you know, everyone at this point, I think, is quite familiar with the growing concentration of wealth. You read about the billionaires every day. The basic background is that over the last 50 years, there's been a massive increase. In the preceding 50 years, there was a massive decrease. So we've effectively returned to the world of 1928. That's a basic fact. And usually we identify the big winners as the top 1%. That's the kind of classic thing. But in fact, all of the relative increase in the concentration of wealth has gone to a much smaller group, the top 0.1%, people who have net worth above about $20 million. But it's not the case that everybody down below the 99.9%, as it were, lost ground. In fact, all of the decrease fell on the bottom 90%. And of course, I should put bottom there in quotes, because that's essentially most people, but not everybody. So in between that 90 and the 0.1%, there is this group, the 9.9%, that has kept even, that turns out to be the wealthiest group in aggregate in our society. So it used to be that the top 0.1% had about, if they had $1, the bottom 90 had $4. Now that's flipped to where it's $1 for the top 0.1% and $1 spread out among everybody in the 90%. And in between, the group in between, the 9.9%, in fact, has about $2.50. So it's richer than the other two put together, and it's kind of kept even. And then the one last important bit of the math that I think we all kind of sense is just this. You can kind of measure the hill that people try to climb in the American economy by looking at what it takes to go from the middle of that 90% to the middle of the 9.9%. So not to reach the very top, not to become Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, but basically to become a successful member of the 9.9%. And 50 years ago, you would have had to multiply your wealth by about 10 times to make that leap. whereas today you have to do it by about 24 times. So the hill of the American dream, as it were, is about 2.5 times as high. And, you know, I guess the broadest point of my book is that change in the slope is affecting us in many more ways than we appreciate, and it's leading us to all to behave in some pretty questionable ways.
It's really interesting because I think a lot of people who are in that 9.9%, as you point out, they don't think of themselves as rich or privileged or that they've gotten any leg up on anyone else. They think it's a meritocracy that got them there. And yet you point out so many interesting things about licensure, for example, doctors, lawyers, accountants, others who have these fields that insulate them, that give them the opportunity to earn when people in their own practice below them, let's say dentists and the dental assistants, are by virtue of the licensure approach really going to be locked out while the dentist is locked in to this 9.9%. But I think it's really worth noting what the group that we're talking about really thinks of how it arrived where it is.
Yeah, so there's this big disconnect. And, you know, the role of a philosopher, I think, is to make a lot of people dislike them. So that's, I think I've achieved that, because what I want to say is that a lot of people in this group, and I'm sort of part of it, well, we're deluding ourselves to a certain degree. The story we tell ourselves is that everything we've earned is a function of our talent and our effort, and that the system is set up so that it distributes rewards in proportion to that talent and effort. But when you look at the numbers, it doesn't add up. And then when you really investigate, you know, our own situation in life, I think it becomes clear. And it happens in many different fields. It's not just in terms of jobs. I think that you can see it in the way our housing system works. You can see it in the way our education system works. And of course, you know, as you point out, you can see it in many of the professional structures. There's a significant amount of, you know, hoarding and hurdles and so on that are set up to protect the people who have arrived and to keep the people who are outside the gates from getting in.
In many ways, I think about the millionaire next door. In other words, a lot of the people we're talking about are not showy. In fact, they may want to hide their wealth, Matthew, so that somebody doesn't come to them and say, gee, you should endow this organization or that. And they may feel a little nervous that they may be out of that 9.9% at any time. I don't know. What is the psychology of this group?
Well, I think you hit on something there by saying, referring to the nervousness. Because I do think that a certain sense of insecurity and fear is there, and it's there basically all the way up. You know, maybe even at the very top, but certainly very high up. I'm sure you've met people who are in the top 1%, the top 0.5%, incredibly wealthy in relative standards, and yet they often feel poor. And I think that one thing that we haven't quite grasped or reckoned with is that in a very unequal society where things are distributed in this kind of unfair and sometimes haphazard way, people do develop they internalize this fear and insecurity, and then that sort of whole lives get sort of built around that. So even though the people in the 9.9% of the wealth distribution have in a certain sense made it, I wouldn't say that they're getting the best of all possible deals. I mean, it's not like they've made it in the shade. They've made it into a kind of very nervous spot where they have to worry constantly about falling down, and also where they can look up and see that there are many people who are doing much, much better than they are. So it's the one thing I guess I want to communicate is that this isn't at the end of the day, the only people who you can really say are winning are the 0.1%. But this other group is engaged in a certain degree of delusion of its own success.
Well, your book subtitle, Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. In other words, most of the people we're talking about, the doctors, the lawyers, the dentists, the mid-level investment bankers, the MBAs with different titles, professionals, managerial types and other professionals, they might look upon it and say, how am I doing that? I give to charity. I'm doing my best. I'm not trying to keep anybody down. I'm trying. I vote for people who are very benign in their intent. many in the suburbs who've been moving away from one party to a different party. So the question is, how are they warping the culture as you see it?
First of all, I'm not someone who thinks that everything reduces down to personal choices. So I'm going to absolve a significant number of our listeners now from personal direct guilt in perpetuating the system. I think the core causes of inequality are, you know, much more structural and economic. They have to do with the crushing of labor. They have to do with tax policy. They have to do with exogenous things that aren't dictated by policy. But there is an important sense in which this group is contributing, and I'll break it into two parts. One, I think you've already touched on, and that's the hoarding aspect, where to a degree that the people don't appreciate, they are participating in these hoarding activities. So, you know, for example, most members of the 9.9%, in fact, it's almost a definition of the members of the 9.9%, own a good house that is appreciated in value in a respectable zip code. I mean, this is kind of a key card for membership in the group. And it's true that individually they may not be accountable for the way those real estate values behave, but they're parts of neighborhoods. They belong to neighborhoods that often practice a pretty aggressive level of restriction, keep new construction out, that effectively have created a housing affordability crisis. So in an indirect way, people who are, you know, going about their lives in their good neighborhoods are doing that. There's another in education. Of course, everyone's going to work to get their kids in the best possible college. But let's face it, people in the who have succeeded are able to master the arcane knowledge, the contacts and so on that will give them and their kids a significant leg up. With the result that the education system, which is supposed to be a leveler, ends up being a way of reproducing class. All of that, though, is in what I would call a kind of hoarding thing, and that's one way in which people do participate in the system. But then the other side of it, I think, is a kind of modeling. So look, when we move around in society, our actions are important not just for what they do to other people immediately around us or how they affect us, but for what they model. We're basically modeling behavior all the time, and we convey a tremendous amount of information, and we influence a lot more than we think in terms of how other people behave in the way that we model behaviors. And, you know, our group is basically modeling a way of life that isn't really attainable or logical or, you know, mathematically feasible for a large number of Americans. So, you know, essentially what we're modeling is this idea that you should strive to go to the best selective college you can. You should raise kids in an incredibly intensive, hothouse kind of way. You should move into the best possible neighborhood to maximize your contacts and so on. That kind of pattern of behavior then it produces a system of values where everybody tries to do the same thing. Everybody's looking for that education. Everybody's looking to raise their kids in the same way. But they can't do it because the money isn't there. You know, we're essentially living a dream, or we're presenting a dream to the world that most people will not be able to fulfill. And in that sense, I think people have to be careful about what they're modeling for other people. So those are the personal ways in which people are involved. But I don't want that to distract from the big structural issues too. I just, in a sense, my question is, why aren't we grappling with the structural issues? And the answer is, to some degree, because we've bought into this 9.9% culture that tells us that everything is actually okay.
By the way, maybe we should even define the number that we're talking about here. Is it still like 1.2 million up to 20 million, including all assets? In other words, as we're looking at this 9.9%, just to make sure people have a frame on the type of wealth that's been accumulated by this group.
At the time of writing the book, the best I had was the 2016 numbers by Zuckman and others. And yeah, they were putting the entry level into the 9.9% at $1.2 million in net assets. And that includes homes, by the way, and includes retirement accounts. The only mathematical criterion I used was very simply at which percentile was the relative wealth concentration kept constant. And it turns out that, in fact, it is at the 90. So basically everything below the 90th percentile, the relative concentration of wealth has been going down, and everything above it has been going up. So it's a bit of an arbitrary cutoff line, but I think it corresponds to something significant. I mean, it's people who have more than $1 million. It's not a lot in some places, I know, and it's different from $20 million, which is a top end. But on the other hand, there are variations in neighborhoods and also variations in life cycle and so on that make the group more comparable. And I think that there's people have a broad sense of what it takes to move, or at least, a certain subset of the American population is what it takes to move up into these things. And then I guess one other point I'll make now that we're talking about those numbers is that it's arbitrary to divide people by wealth quartile. But here's one thing that shows up, and it's kind of interesting. There is an age skew. There's a race skew, which is not terribly surprising, but there's it's unfortunate but not surprising, but there's an age skew. Essentially, a lot of the older boomers have, in fact, been the ones who have benefited from the appreciation of house values and who have benefited from the retirement accounts. And so they've been pushed up into this group, whereas the millennials and below have been the ones who have tended to be pushed out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you make such a great point that so many of the benefits that the 9.9% have are invisible, whether it's deducting from your home mortgage interest on your taxes, whether it has been even your property taxes have been allowed to be deducted from your federal. And I know that's something that's still being debated about the maximum on that. And then, of course, other benefits like health care benefits that are not taxed, a whole range of things. And yet when we are debating in our society, and too little, I think, the benefit that needs to go down to help the 90% move up, they're very visible. And it may be a food stamp increase, it may be this, that, or the other. And all of a sudden, the attention drawn to that is so great. But these invisible benefits just go on and on. I was at the dog park yesterday, and I was talking about the 2017 tax law. And this guy who is a financial planner said, I couldn't believe it, that you could write off all the entire value of a jet as a result of the 2017 tax law. I don't think a lot of people in that 90% are buying jets.
No, I think that your point, Larry, about invisibility is so central to this whole problem that we face, because people just don't understand where the money is coming from, and they tend to think that it is all their own work and their own specialness. And the tax code in particular is a great example of how we manage to deceive ourselves. So most people, if you ask them in the United States, do we have a progressive system of tax, that is, we tax richer people more, they would look at the federal income tax rate and say, well, of course we do. There's a higher income tax bracket, and it's 39.6% and so on, and it goes down. So clearly we have a progressive tax system. But in fact, we don't. We have a system that is close to flat, and actually goes down to the wealthiest people, and goes down to incredibly low levels for the super wealthy because they make most of their money through capital gains. How do we get away with this? How do we deceive ourselves and imagine that we have a progressive system when in fact we have a flat tax that's incredibly inefficient and regressive? Well, it's because of the invisibility. We don't factor in that there is this regressive payroll tax structure. We don't factor in generally the state taxes, which often have huge regressive components and sales taxes and so on. And we overlook, as you point out, all the crazy loopholes that allow wealthy people to get around taxes. And so, we think we're in this reality where, rich people are paying more. And in fact, they're not. And the same is true in so many other fields. In housing, it's a similar situation. When people talk about government and housing, they imagine that, whenever the government intervenes in the housing market, it must be just to help poor people. And that's because it's the most obvious thing. There's a program to build housing for low-income people. But it turns out that the government actually spends a lot more money, directly and indirectly, subsidizing wealthy homeowners. It's significantly more money. So the government is in the market, and it's not helping all the people who are championing their independence and personal responsibility. It's helping the people who are pretending that they're not getting any help. So we need to be a little more honest, I think, with ourselves about what's actually happening.
Yeah, I think you're being kind there. Matthew Stewart, author of 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. You write that we 9.9%ers live in safer neighborhoods, we go to better schools, have shorter commutes, receive higher quality health care, and when circumstances require, serve time in better prisons. Yeah, I've known some of the white-collar criminals you're talking about. We also have more friends, the kind of friends who will introduce us to new clients, line up great internships for our kids. Again, it's a self-fulfilling thing. And there's another term that's used in some of your writing, intergenerational earnings elasticity. Do you want to break any of that down for us?
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that connects with the issue of social mobility, right? Social and economic mobility. And as we all know, that story of mobility is a key part of the American self-image. You can go from rags to riches. You can work your way up. You can come over as a street sweeper from Italy, and then, you know, in the next generation, your kids are making a fortune as investment bankers. Trust me, I've heard this story many, many times. It's very important. It turns out it's less true now, significantly less true, and it's less true precisely because inequality is rising, the hill's getting steeper, and it's harder to move. And so one way you can measure all of this is through the intergenerational earnings elasticity, and it's just a measure for how much of the children's income can be explained by the parents' income, right? So a very high number means that the two are very closely related. If dad is rich, son is rich. If mom is low income, daughter is low income, that kind of thing. And it turns out that number has been going up. First of all, it's higher in the United States than it is in many other countries, which means we have less mobility here. So the land of your dreams turns out to be the land of not great mobility. But it's getting worse, and it's getting worse because of inequality. And you can see that when you compare, when you look at what happens to that rate and compare it with inequality in different countries and across time. So mobility is going down, and that's a function of inequality. But there's something else, too, that I think we have to add to this discussion, and that's that you need to ask whether mobility itself really does justify a system, or if it's just a characteristic of a well-functioning system. I think everyone would agree that it's good to have people moving around. It shows that the system is sorting people according to how much they work and how other factors, and there's a certain randomness in life. But just put it this way, in terms of a thought experiment, if you had a society in which, you know, one person had all the wealth and nine people basically had to agree to be that person's servant, but then you allowed people to move and change spots every 10 or 50 years, would that be a just society? I mean, it would have perfect mobility, but it would be incredibly unequal, and I think it would be very unjust. So we need to ask what kind of mobility we're looking for, and of course we need to make sure that we get some mobility, and those are very serious problems that we're now facing. And what's happening with the 9.9%, of course, is that it is over time increasingly entrenching itself, and you can just see that. You know, it's clear as day if you go into one of these nice college campuses. I mean, I love the people there, but, you know, look at the parking lots, look at the clothes they're wearing. I mean, you know that you can just see that. I don't have to tell you the statistic that, you know, something like 70% of the class at Yale comes from the top quintile of the income distribution. About half of them are from the 9.9%.
We also, in your writing, talk about the politics of resentment. And, of course, it's so interesting that some of the people that, they turn to, those who are in that bottom 90%, if you will, they look to somebody who perhaps has a rags-to-riches story saying, you know, that's the guy I want to lead me because he's done it. And, of course, the person in particular that they look to did it with all kinds of benefit and all kinds of chicanery that went on to amass that wealth and to lose it five times over. But you say we're leaving the 90% and their offspring far behind in a cloud of debts and bad life choices that they somehow can't stop themselves from making. So do we justify whatever we're not wanting to do from a policy standpoint, or can't see the invisibility and yet the profound impact of the benefit that we're getting based on how the society has, stacked the deck, if you will. And we're able to do that because we say to ourselves, they just can't get their act together. And, of course, in many ways, like Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, they don't even see what's in their own economic benefit, and they're voting often for people who are making the deck more heavily stacked against them.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that happen as inequality rises. And if you don't mind, I'll make some kind of abstract world historical point and see if I can relate it to what's happening. What's happening, it's clear, is a kind of breakdown of reason and rationality in our political discourse in our society. This is not to say that we were ever perfectly reasonable, but, you know, the level of discourse now is pretty appalling. You know, people can tell lies, presidents can tell lies in broad daylight, and somehow they can't be corrected, you know, huge parts of the population. So the question is, why is that happening? And the short answer is inequality, but the way it works now is complex. So on the one hand, yeah, as you say, you get a large group of people who will tend to become resentful, will tend to take a very dim view of the all of society. They basically assume that anybody who's made it has just been really good at ripping off any other person. And so that's why, to some degree, they go for the guy who's the biggest crook, because they think, yeah, he's been the most successful, he's ripped off most people. So they develop that resentment. But then other things kick in, too. It turns out that the 0.1% or the people who are really pulling a lot of the strings, a lot of the power strings, they come to understand that it's in their interest to manipulate this group below. This is something that essentially Thomas Frank was arguing, and makes a lot of sense to me. They need to manipulate those people. And, of course, they invest. They invest in making those people basically unreasonable, into kind of, you know, feeding them disinformation and giving them, you know, pat ideologies that seem to explain their world, but in fact just to get them to support the cause of the plutocracy. And then there is another thing that I wanted to draw attention to, and it's a little more subtle, but and it has to do with the 9.9%. I think that historically there was this positive side to the professional upper middle class, in that it embodied a certain set of commitments to rational standards. I mean, that's the basic idea behind professions and behind management, if they're well done, right? It's that you have a group of people who are committed to, you know, serving clients' interests, to advancing things in a reasonable way. And I think what happens as inequality rises is that this group stops performing its function. It gets much more focused on protecting its privilege, on hoarding, on making sure that nobody gets in. And it has much less interest in, you know, promoting these kinds of rational standards. And so I think we've seen this kind of breakdown in the function of this rational professional group in many sectors. We've seen it in journalism. We've seen it in education. And of course, above all, we've seen it in politics. And so I think that's a contributing factor to the kind of craziness that we see around us.
You also point out that we've seen it in areas like finance and Wall Street, where, again, you know, the end game and the goal is just to accumulate more. It's not really adding a whole lot of benefit. That's why a lot of people going outside of the system into cryptocurrency saying, why do I need you? What value are you adding to the product? And even as it relates to the medical system, I think you pointed out that doctors in America make so much more than they do elsewhere in the world, and yet the results just don't match the recompense that they're getting.
Yeah, and on the financial sector, I do like to look at things that in a kind of macro level and ask a basic question. How much money do we spend, or what share of our gross products do we spend in just allocating things financially, that is, in deciding who gets which dollar, right? So, which is the basic function of the financial system. That's what banks do. They loan money. They accept deposits and loan and so on. Well, it turns out that over the last 50 years, that number has gone from about less than 3% of the economy to something closer to 8% of the economy. So financial services represents now 8% of the economy, or one out of every $12. But if the basic function of that one out of every $12 is just to kind of help allocate the other 11, you do have to, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of unnecessary shuffling of money going on. And yet this is where the great concentrations of wealth, or one of the great big pools, is happening, right? And what's the psychology that produces? You know, it's pretty straightforward. I don't think I have to be a brilliant psychologist to say that if you create an economy that has a huge casino right in the middle of it, this is not going to be good.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about tax expenditures, which I think a lot of people don't even know what they mean, but these are through deductions for retirement savings, you know, all the benefit that helps the 9.9% accrue what they have. Let me just read something you wrote. The best thing about this program of reverse taxation, as far as the 9.9% are concerned, is that the bottom 90% haven't got a clue. The working classes get riled up when they see someone at the grocery store flipping out their food stamps to buy a T-bone. They have no idea that a nice family on the other side of town is walking away with $100,000 for flipping their home. And then you just talk about so many of these injustices and indignities to one's conscience. If you really wanted to start over and build a system that was just fairer, it doesn't mean that the 9.9%, even in that construct, is not going to do well. But again, they don't have to be hoarding, as you say, all of the goods and all of the benefits in the society. So I guess my question is, we need to get to this at the end of our conversation. I mean, what can we do, particularly anybody who's listening, who may be in this group, and, you know, congratulations. But, you know, what do we do to make things fairer? Things seem so out of whack in our society, and there's so much political turbulence given this unrest. And I don't think any of the answers or the actors in the political system are really helping a lot at this point. So what do people with a conscience who really are trying to do their best and not really even aware of the benefit they're accruing in the way the game is played today, what can they do?
Again, I do want to say that I believe that we can work together and we can achieve collective goals, and we can often do it through government, although there are other vehicles. So, you know, there's a part of the solution involves policy, and we just have to accept that, and we have to advocate for those policies. And I don't think that they're all that hard to find, at least a lot of them. I don't think you have to look for really exotic things, and I'm going to count universal basic income as one of the exotics. I don't think you have to go that far, because many other countries have taken important steps, and you know, people in this country are trying to take important steps that will contribute to the solution. They won't get us 100% of the way there, but they will get us pretty far. You know, our healthcare system, we pay twice as much as the rest of the world for worse results. Come on, we can fix that, and other countries have done so better than we have. So there's a significant policy element, and we should all continue to work for that. It doesn't all necessarily go through government. But then there's something more personal, I think. And honestly, I think it may be just what people do for themselves. I mean, what I find is that, yes, a fair number of people are happy with the game. Usually they're the ones who are winning in it. But there are quite a number of people who get caught up in this 9.9% game who at some level understand that it's not actually working, or it doesn't really make sense for them. And I would just invite those people to think about pursuing other ways to achieve self-realization. You know, maybe this idea of, you know, putting it all into the meritocratic professional career, or, you know, trying to find that niche in the corporate hierarchy. I understand the survival pressures at stake, and I don't want to diminish those, but, you know, just think really hard about whether that's actually in your best interest, or if there's some other form of living that can make more sense. So I think even those levels of individual choices can have an impact. Because as I said, I think there's a modeling aspect to what we do. We have a need as a culture to sort of rethink some of our basic suppositions, because they're leading us kind of collectively to some serious problems. I mean, we're not able to confront not just inequality, but a connected issue of environmental damage and many other, you know, very serious threats. And if we don't sort of rethink our approach at this kind of basic level, we will all, you know, face significant problems. And, you know, we can all contribute to a solution by looking to ourselves and what we're doing. And I suppose finally, you know, a fair number of people in this group are actually involved in philanthropy. And while I don't think philanthropy is a solution for all the problem, it is, I think, an important part of raising consciousness and increasing contact and becoming more aware of you know, what's actually happening in our world.
You do say that the recency, so how recent this phenomenon is, may likewise play a role in our failure to recognize our growing privileges. It's taken less than one lifetime for the never fully formed meritocracy to evolve into a fledgling aristocracy. Now, how long can this go on? I mean, again, the system seems about ready to fray in many places. And, you know, people questioning its legitimacy in many ways, and just people acknowledging that something is really wrong here. I mean, so what happens from here? I mean, historically, and as you see it, if this has happened so fast, it's come on so quickly, it's obviously a distortion. So can this go on?
What history shows us is that it corrects itself in a bad way. And I'm sorry to spread that unfortunate message, but when inequality gets to this kind of level, you end up with a system that is quite unstable. The economic instability is kind of clear, and then we already had a big taste of that in the last decade, so I think that's everyone's familiar with that. The political instability has been kicking in over the last 4 years, and now we're all getting a good taste of that. The process only really moves in one direction. It just, you know, inequality tends to feed on itself, and it then tends to produce more instability, which exacerbates inequality until, of course, you get a major shock or realignment, you know, and that's what happened in the Great Depression and World War II, for example. You know, that's what history tells us. The other thing that history tells us, by the way, is that these things do move pretty fast. I mean, I've been, you know, looking over the history of the antebellum period in the United States, and, you know, by 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, there was, as we all know, this incredible oligarchy in the South, massive concentration of wealth in the very top few slaveholders, and they intermarried and so on, and resulted in lots of bad movies being made. And this oligarchy really came into being over not that many generations. I mean, it was took, you know, perhaps three or four generations in that case, but you know, it's not surprising that really in one or two at this point we've been evolving towards a new system. And the reason why I say it's such a short period is that I myself have experienced this. I mean, you know, most of my childhood was spent in a very, you know, I think it was a different kind of world, far from a perfect one, but where, let's say, the egalitarian assumptions were, I think, more prominent than they are now.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember old neighborhoods where you had the doctors and the lawyers mingling with all the rest of us. We all had one car. I mean, it was a very modest home. I mean, things have really changed, as you say, very quickly for the next generation. But whether that continues for the baby boomers' kids, that's a whole nother issue. Matthew Stewart, though, again, the best thing going for those kids is the wealth that's been accumulated by the baby boomers. The author of this really incredible book, The 9.9%, I would really encourage you to get this book, because I think if you're going to have arguments with people, and there are a lot of people to have arguments with in our culture today, some of the statistics and some of the benefits that accrue that are invisible, he really points them out so brilliantly and really gets you thinking and your head spinning. I thank you, Matthew, for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, thank you, Larry. Pleasure to be here.